SPR talk by Matt Colburn, Sticky Bundles, Leaky Buckets and Rabbit Holes, Understanding the Survival Experience. This is Gwen Tatum Memorial Lecture, 5th of March 2020.
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the SPR lecture tonight, the Gwen Tate lecture. Henry Tate gave some money to the SPR over a 20-year period because his daughter Gwen had died at an early age, and he was interested in aspects of survival, what survived, how we survive. And on the understanding that the SPR would hold two lectures, especially on survival, each year. And also he gave a sum of money for us to do research work. And we have an SPR committee called the Survival Research Committee, and Dr. Matthew Coburn and I, we're both members of that. So we're obviously both very interested in survival, as are many of you, obviously. And I'm glad so many people have managed to come tonight as well. Now tonight, Dr. Matthew Coburn is talking on understanding survival experience.
Well done for making it. I think between the rain and the coronavirus, we should all give ourselves a brownie point to start off with. It's funny because when I sort of volunteered to do this lecture earlier this year, I thought it would be quite a nice opportunity for me to kind of pull some of my own thoughts about survival and the various issues together that I've been sort of pondering for some time. And the first thing that you notice when wading into the literature is the ferocious controversies. So I think I'm going to be asking your indulgence tonight. What I want to do, and we're going to have to play it by ear a little bit as far as time is concerned, because there's a lot of stuff, and I'm going to be including or skipping things depending on what the clock is saying, basically. But it's also that we're going to be having a look at what some of the critics are saying as well. So I think I'd approach this almost like a juror on a court, in a court case, thinking what, you know, it's all about adjudicating what people are claiming, and the claims and counterclaims can be quite complex and involved. Hopefully not too complex and involved. I'm going to start by making a relatively uncontroversial statement, I hope, which is that I think whatever anyone thinks experience is like, mediumship sort of experiences, near-death experiences, apparitions of the dead, whatever anyone thinks of these, I think it can't be denied that they're psychological, sociological, and anthropological realities. So even in a sort of august academic, you know, conventional context, I think I've made the claim that it's legitimate to study these from those particular perspectives. And when you start looking into the literature, you realise how wide and rich these sorts of experiences are. So I'm going to start with an example. It's quoted in The Flip, but it was originally from a book called Beyond Knowing. The American forensic pathologist Dr. Janice Amatuzio recounted this tale. This began one night when Amatuzio encountered a very troubled hospital chaplain in the course of her work. He asked to go back to her office, where he then asked her if she knew how they had found the body of a young man recently killed in a car accident. She replied that her record showed that the Coon Rapids Police Department had recovered the body in a frozen creek bed at about 4:45 a.m. No, the man replied. Do you know how they really found him? The chaplain then explained how he'd spoken to the dead man's wife, who related how she had had a vivid dream that night of her husband standing next to her bed, apologising and explaining that he had been in a car accident and that his car was in a ditch where it could not be seen from the road. She awoke immediately at 4:20 a.m. and called the police to tell them that her husband had been in a car accident not far from their home, and that his car was in a ravine that could not be seen from the road. They recovered the body 25 minutes later. So the literature's replete in experiences like that. Well, how about this one? On 30th of January 1978, a Monday, I got a telephone call in the evening. The phone did not ring normally, but with a deadened sound, so at first I did not know if it was a call or not. I picked up the receiver asking, "Hello, hello." All of a sudden I heard, distinctly and unmistakably real, my father's voice. My father died on the 24th of September 1974 at the age of 56. I heard his voice quite clearly. "I'm here, Daddy. Here, here, Daddy." At the third time, he said it more intensely. "Here, Daddy," asking immediately afterwards, "How is Mummy? How is Mummy?" And all of a sudden, the whole thing was over and gone. So there's that kind of experience. I think anyone who came to the talk last year, apparitional sort of experience, perhaps. And of course, the first one, the early SPR collected quite a few examples of those sorts of cases. So that's one sort of survival experience. But there are other ones, like visions of the other world, and these quite often, but not invariably, occur in the context of near-death experiences. Some of the most interesting ones that I've sort of come across are actually from a study of Mormon near-death experiences, where the other world is described in quite a lot of detail. So I can remember it all, even though it was a long time ago. I was in a big garden and I could see a stream and trees laden with pomegranates. It was extremely bright and there were people there. Here's another one. "I don't know how I got there, but I found myself on a beautiful country lane. I was strolling down the lane slowly and I felt I had all the time in the world. I could hear skylarks singing and I thought, oh, how lovely." And there are even cities with libraries in them, in these particular sets of near-death experiences. At one point, one of the witnesses was taken to another large room similar to a library. "As I looked around it, it seemed to be a repository of knowledge, but I couldn't see any books. Then I noticed ideas coming into my mind, knowledge filling me on subjects that I had not thought about for some time, or in some cases not at all. Then I realised it was a library of the mind." So they're extraordinary, actually. It's well worth taking the trouble to dig out that. It's mentioned by Alan Keller here from the specific study of Mormon near-death experiences. But here we're having apparent rich descriptions of another world. So you've got that body of this wide range of experience that I've only briefly touched upon. For the purpose of this lecture, I thought, rather than look at back at Victorian or quite old cases, I want to look at relatively contemporary material. So if anyone thinks, well, where is that stuff? It's a deliberate decision that I've made, because I think I want to sharpen the focus on the contemporary debate. But it's not to say that that's not a rich field as well. I mean, you know, I was looking at the mediumship of Klusky, for example. Very baffling and weird, and I honestly don't know what to make of that material either. But I think it's important that we move swiftly on to the roadblock, which is that the advance of neuroscience, the quite staggeringly scary advance of neuroscience, and in fact some are claiming with a relative amount of justification that mind reading technology is already here. Essentially, what we've got is neuroimaging and EEG techniques that are good enough to, via artificial intelligence, be translated. It's more limited than some of the hype suggests at the moment, and there's some debate about how far this technology will go. But it's a rapidly burgeoning field, so to a certain degree, inner voice, some visual data from the visual cortex, and other features like, for example, musical recognition, can be you can basically, a researcher can have a look at what the brain's doing and guess what a musical tune someone is thinking of from neuroimaging information. And there's been a lot of excited talk in the neuroscience community recently about how far that can go. Elon Musk has set up Neuralink, where he's actually trying, they're starting off with people with paraplegic, it's basically inserting chips into people's heads, but also via, head, basically skull caps and things, already on the market are things like drones you can control with your thoughts. So I think we can debate on what, if anything, that tells us about the mind-body problem, but this, I think it's important to understand that in years to come, when we discuss things like the survival issue, this issue is going to be increasingly used as a reason to dismiss the whole field. One example is a relatively recent book by Daniel Bohr. This is an experience. I think it's important to understand how people's personal experiences shape their attitudes to the material. So, on the night of Thursday, May the 8th, 1997, my father had a stroke. When I visited him in the hospital, I felt profoundly disturbed by what I witnessed. This sluggish, exhausted man in front of me looked like my father, but I knew deep down that it wasn't. There were subtle clues that betrayed this imposter. Some were comical, like a newfound obsession with Kit Kats. Others were more disconcerting. These differences could be generally characterised as a reversion from a sharp, responsible man into a confused child. Now, at the time, Bohr was studying philosophy and biological psychology, and he writes, on the one hand, I was revising elegant philosophical arguments proposing that consciousness was non-physical and had little to do with brains. On the other hand, I was poring over the evidence for whether consciousness lay in this cortical region or that, and learning the details of neglect. Here was a man I loved deeply, robbed of his identity because a small clot on his brain had potently wounded his consciousness. Of course consciousness is a physical thing, I thought, as I sat on his left. Basically, he had some hemispheric problems, so Bohr's father behaved to him differently, depending on where he sat. And I think it's important to understand that obviously had a deep emotional impact. Quite often, with the rhetoric of these things, it's, the very rational people versus very emotional people. And actually, I think emotional experiences have a very strong impact, again, on how we view the material. And then later, he describes how he went into a neuroimager for a particular study. And the researcher was able to deduce what he was thinking indirectly from imagining various actions. It's similar to the experience that researchers had with a locked-in patient. They asked them to imagine playing tennis and things like that. So that's an indirect sort of way of mind reading. But his conclusion, he believed that it led to, I have just participated in the most definitive demonstration in existence that the mind is nothing more than the brain. So to Bohr, that's enough. So, and he dismisses any of those philosophical objections to physicalism. So that, according to him, there's no more debate. Okay, let's go down the pub so we finish the lecture. No, not really. So I think it's important to appreciate this this roadblock, and a lot of the objections were made very explicit at great length. It's upstairs in a book called The Myth of an Afterlife by Martin and Austin. We'll be hearing a bit more about Keith Austin a bit later in the context of Pam Reynolds. So we have the sort of sceptical community basically coming up with a response to books like Irreducible Mind. Coyne, this was in a book called Why Evolution is True, actually a very good book, but all the way along he mixes in proof of evolution with proof of materialism. So he claims at one point the message of evolution and all of science is one of naturalistic materialism. So, it doesn't matter what experiences people have. We, you know, as far as science is concerned, it's a waste of time thinking about it. And this is actually, it's rubbed off a little bit in our psychology. In 2002, Irwin asked whether the scientific investigation of post-mortem survival was an anachronism. And he claimed that, strictly speaking, the scientific investigation of survival hypothesis is not viable because it's not been shown to be empirically testable. So it's even rubbed off on parapsychology. But many hidden assumptions operating underground here, which I'm going to leave to the end. Skeptical leap of faith, and those annoying philosophers that bore this light so much have claimed the case for or against an afterlife is best understood in the light of one's overall metaphysics. Ruling out an afterlife as impossible is philosophically tenuous. So I think that's a significant counterclaim, that we are perhaps premature in rejecting out of hand thoughts about possible afterlives or survival. And they offer some justifications. This is from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, a very good and even-handed article on the afterlife. And they suggest several reasons. If you love persons and hope for their enduring flourishing, thinking about the implications of there not being an afterlife or there being one, I defy anyone to tell me they've never wondered either way a little bit. Well, maybe some people, but, you know, certainly I have. And of course for historical reasons. And this is a fourth reason, which is, despite Irwin, it's difficult to avoid speculating about an afterlife when presented with evidence that suggests it. I think the problem is it's the usual thing. We live in a particularly polarised era where everyone's in a sort of reality tunnelling confirmation bias. We're all terribly prone to basically attending to things that back up our preconceived ideas, not attending to things that don't. And I think it affects everyone, particularly in this debate. And I'd also claim that personal experience hugely impacts personal metaphysics. Just quickly, because I notice we're moving on a little bit, but I dislike the crude polarisation skeptic versus believer. I think it's way too crude and unrepresentative of the patterns of belief and experience out there. These are four, they're not exhaustive and they're probably unsatisfactory, but I tentatively call the conservative physicalist someone who rejects parapsychology and possible survival out of hand, very strongly opposes religion. And the ground metaphysics for that reason is hardline physicalism. Liberal physicalists, and there are those about, I just read Damien Broderick's review of Matlock's book on reincarnation. He accepts psi, but he really doesn't like, or doesn't seem to be very happy with approaching the material on survival. And I get the general sense that religion is sort of tends to be de-emphasised. Again, these generalisations, I'm not really trying to be too exact here. Radical anti-materialism, in some ways, I would say that's people who tend to strongly accept parapsychology and survival, maybe sympathetic on religion. Again, I'm not making any claims. I've included some names. It's just general reading here. But just to give a general idea. And finally, humanities, where people tend to look at the meaning of these experiences, things like content analysis, symbolism, and it tends to be more postmodern and pluralistic, so perhaps open to multiple different... and it tends to look at the metaphorical content of some of these experiences, which I have to say that, being annoying, I've learned something from each of these positions myself, so they're not to be rejected. So I think we need to go straight on to NDEs. Proposed as evidence of survival for quite a long time. Cook, Grayson and Stevenson in 1998 drew attention to enhanced mentation, out-of-body experiences and apparent paranormal perception as three features that might suggest survival. But of course there are conventional counter-explanations for these, so a lot of it's going to hinge on the detail. The devil is in the detail on whether we actually think these are strong evidence or even moderate evidence for some kind of either paranormal functioning or survival. So I thought I'd look at the one of the strongest case studies that in the literature, which is Pam Reynolds' NDE. And again, I'm going to be doing some reading. It's worth taking a little bit of time thinking about the details. Some of this comes from the Science Encyclopedia, but the original account is in Michael Sabin's Light and Death, and it was part of the Atlanta study of near-death experience that Michael Sabin did. I think it was launched in 1994. So the significance of Pam Reynolds is that it was an apparently veridical NDE during surgery on a brain aneurysm that happened in 1991. So, at the age of 35, Reynolds experienced dizziness, loss of speech, and difficulty moving her body. And a scan revealed a giant aneurysm at the base of her brain. So basically, there needed to be an operation to remove this. A neurologist to whom she was referred predicted little or no chance of survival because of its size and location. So, Robert Spelzer, who was the surgeon, pioneered a surgical procedure including hypothermic cardiac arrest. You basically stop the heart and you cool the body and drain the brain of blood so you can operate on the aneurysm. So at the time it was a very pioneering operation. Involving more than 20 doctors, nurses and technicians, and her vital signs were monitored, and she had some earphones over her ears which were feeding clicks into her ears it was basically for an EEG response. So she was placed in hypothermia, like I said, for the operation. The blood was drained and the EEG was flat for part of the procedure. Ears were covered and it was fed loud clicks. Just before we get into the experience, this is a diagram. So you've got the surgical microscope here, you've got Pam Reynolds here, and you've got the neurosurgeons, the evoked potential EEG monitoring here, pump oxygenator. So, I think it's worth actually turning to some of her own words. This is from Sabin's Light and Death. She suddenly became conscious. The next thing I recall was the sound. As I listened, it was a natural D. As I listened to the sound, I felt it was pulling me out of the top of my head. The further out of my body I got, the more clear the tone became. I had the impression that it was like a road, a frequency that you got on. I remember seeing several things in the operating room when I was looking down. It was the most aware that I think I've ever been in my life. I was metaphorically sitting on Dr. Speltzer's shoulder. It was not like normal vision. It was brighter and more focused and clearer. There was so much in the operating room that I didn't recognise, and so many people. I saw the thing that I hated the sound of. It looked like, this is the saw, the surgical saw. It looked like an electrical toothbrush, and it had a dent in it, a groove at the top where the saw appeared to go into the handle but didn't. There's a bit of poor description of this. I saw the saw crank up. I didn't see them use it on my head, but I think I heard it being used on something. It was humming at a relatively high pitch, and all of a sudden it went through like that. Bit of a description of the ongoing surgery, sort of the removal of part of the skull, exposure of the brain. Someone said something about my veins and arteries being very small. I believe it was a female voice and that it was Dr. Murray, but I'm not sure. She was a cardiologist. I remember thinking that I should have told her about that. I remember the heart-lung machine. So she recognised details as the surgery was ongoing. And then basically the core temperature, her core temperature was, so at this point, this is before the draining. And then her core temperature is brought down and her EEG goes flat, although there is some dispute over the timing, but we'll just attend to the experience itself. Yes, as Pam's heart arrested, her brain waves flattened to complete electrocerebral silence. Brain stem function weakened as clicks from the ear speakers produced lower and lower spikes on the monitoring electrogram. So, here's the substance of the near-death experience. There's a sensation of being pulled, but not against your will. I was going on my own accord because I want to. It was like Wizard of Oz being taken up in a tornado vortex, only you're not spinning around like you've got vertigo. You're very focused and you have a place to go. Feeling was going like going up in an elevator real fast. At some point very early in the tunnel vortex, I became aware of my grandmother calling me, but I didn't hear her call me with my ears. It was clearer hearing than with my ears. And then there's the tunnel sensation, familiar from other near-death experience. The feeling was that she wanted me to come down to her, so I continued with no fear down the shaft. It's a dark shaft that I went through, and at the very end, there was this very little pinpoint of light that kept getting bigger and brighter. The light was incredibly bright, like sitting in the middle of a light bulb. And then she begins to discern different figures in the light. Covered with light, they were light, they had light permeating all around them. And I could see that one of them was my grandmother. Everyone I saw looking back on it fit perfectly into my understanding of what the person looked like. So she saw other relatives as well. And then this is an interesting detail, which I'll return to right at the end. The blood was completely drained from her body, the aneurysm sacs collapsed, the operation was completed, and then basically they started up the heart again, and warm blood begins to be reinfused back into Pam's body. And Sabum actually notes here, Pam's body appeared to be waking up, perhaps at the time during her near-death experience when she was being strengthened. In Pam's world, she's in this other world, remember, then they, deceased relatives, were feeding me. They were not doing this through any mouth, like with food, but they were nourishing me with something. The only way I know how to put it is with something sparkly. I definitely recall the sensation of being nurtured and fed and being made strong. And then there are some issues with starting up her heart, but eventually she... we can turn the page here. She has another out-of-body experience when she sees her body at the end of the experience, and she says it looked terrible, like a train wreck. But then she had to go back into her body, and she said it was like diving into a pool of ice water. It hurt. So it's quite a striking experience, that. You know, we've also got some claims about, well, that basically for a period of the middle of the operation, blood drain and EEG flat for part of the procedure. So what do the counter-advocates make of this? I'll just actually dwell. The claim is basically, before we go on to that, the claim is basically that Pam was able to see details of a surgery that she couldn't have known at a particular time during the operation, and that also a part of her near-death experience happened when the EEG was actually flat. So that's quite important to understand the counter-advocates. So Keith Augustine actually wrote a very... I've got a reference list here, by the way, if anyone wants it at the end, you're welcome to get the gory details. In the Journal of Near-Death Studies in 2007, Keith Augustine wrote a paper asking, does paranormal perception occur in near-death experiences? And amongst other cases, he reconstructs very carefully Pam Reynolds case, and suggests several quite harsh things, as critics tend to. He claims the case was misrepresented by Sabum and others. Two glaring errors, and the errors that he claims are that Reynolds did not have her NDE during any period of the flat EEG, and she had no cerebral cortical activity for no longer than roughly half an hour. And he actually does a, perhaps should have put this on the slide, but we can just quickly hold this up. He actually has a reconstructed, you can't see this, but it has a reconstructed timeline of, he tries to mark out when the near-death experience actually happened. And actually, this time-stamping thing has been acknowledged by others to be an issue. A lot of the strength of the claim of paranormality for near-death experience rests on exactly when the experience happened. And the reason is, the reason is that basically, if it happened when the EEG was actually flat, we can presume, well, this is perhaps, you know, it's more anomalous than if the EEG wasn't flat, basically, and the brain is functioning more normally. So he suggests a physiological explanation, anaesthesia awareness. Effectively, he claims that the near-death experience didn't happen when the EEG was flat. It happened either before or afterwards, with some, perhaps, retrospective reconstruction. And that she incorporated either things she heard or things that she'd learnt by other means into this, well, he's assuming it's an hallucination. So that was his suggested explanation. He noted that anaesthesia awareness is actually quite common, and that conscious or semi-conscious audio perceptions aren't that rare in these cases of anaesthesia awareness. And then he sort of questions how accurate was it really, and concludes, Reynolds could have heard her surroundings but not seen them since her eyes were taped shut, and the facts of the case strongly suggest it was exactly what happened. I'm not going to go into the details of all, there are tons of physiological theories for NDEs and out-of-body experiences. The essence is basically that when sensory information is cut to a minimum, the brain reconstructs your sort of point of view from, say, the ceiling or whatever, and it's all internal to the brain. And of course, Augustine is in the hardline physicalism camp, so he rejects any possibility of psi influence. So, what did the near-death experience researchers have to say about this, the other guys? And in the journal Near-Death Studies, the response, there was a response from Bruce Brayson. He said, Augustine's critique is unsubstantiated speculation. And Charles Tart suggested there are inaccuracies and misleading statements in Keith Augustine's deconstruction of Pam Reynolds' near-death experiences. Reynolds' description implied quite clearly that her NDE went on all through the standstill to and beyond the reinfusion of warm blood. And Tart also claimed that Augustine neglected to mention the 100 decibel level of the clicks, which is the level of the sound of a full symphony orchestra playing really loud, making room noise quite effectively, masking room noise quite effectively. So, we've got a debate on, in Augustine's paper, there's a whole thing on whether the earphones really covered the ear and whether, you know, they were really masking the sound or not. I think they're quite right to say that Augustine's paper has a lot of speculations in it. But I think what it does, so I personally think that it's not proved. I mean, I looked through this, it's quite sobering, it's a careful reconstruction. But on the other hand, I don't think either Augustine or strictly Satan have actually proved their case. I come down on a not proven. I think it's a very interesting and rich and remarkable NDE. But if, you know, reading this fully and frankly, I actually found it quite tricky to make a judgment who was right. And what I would say is there are untested hypotheses here. Augustine makes a number of claims that, strictly speaking, haven't been tested. But then Sabin makes a number of claims that, strictly speaking, haven't been tested as well. So we're kind of back to square one. Just widening the discussion a little bit. That's from Cook, Grayson and Stevenson, who are suggesting, you know, that you should look to NDEs for evidence of survival, but they admit it's far from compelling. This might sound like I'm being horrible about NDEs, but actually I find the phenomenon very interesting. It's just, I think, if you want to strictly say whether it's nailing down proof of survival, I think it's a lot harder than is sometimes made out in some of the talks that I've seen, looking at the literature. But again, we can discuss that at the end. The religious and spiritual dimensions are actually crucial, but likely to raise rationalist hackles. Remember back to the hardline physicalists, don't like religion at all. But actually, I think, you know, putting my transpersonal psychologist hat on, I think in some ways I find near-deaths more interesting for their transpersonal aspects and the transformative aspect they have on people's lives. You know, I think something remarkable happens. I'm not debating that. The question I'm asking is, how close are we to actually proving, you know, something truly anomalous with NDEs? Rather nice Renaissance painting that. Our time is moving on a little bit. So basically, there are at least some NDE or NDE-like experiences that are blatantly hallucinatory. And there was one actually in the Paranormal Review in 1998, which had some similar, you know, there was a, it was reported by a late, Mrs. S.J., who was respondent to Donald West's questionnaire on experiences. It was an experience in an emergency caesarean section. Next thing I remember is feeling as if I were completely weightless floating in space. I was surrounded by brilliant pulsating light. The whole space was coloured azure, fading away to paler and paler shades of blue. I was being asked questions by someone I couldn't see. The questions were of life and death importance, and I knew whether I lived or died depending on the answers I gave, even though I cannot now remember what the questions were. When I asked correctly, my body would soar even higher, but when I got a question wrong, my body fell down through space. So finally, she knew all the secrets of the universe. I soared higher and higher in space, and the music became triumphant because I had unlocked the secret of everlasting life. The face behind the disembodied voice was now about to be revealed to me. The voice sounded very familiar, and suddenly I could see the speaker in all his glory. It was Bamba Gascoigne of University Challenge. So that's clearly hallucinatory. But very similar. But still, I think that conclusion stands. But I think we actually need to move on. So I'm going to park NDEs for the moment. Just very quickly, case studies are limited. Remember, we're not studying experience, we're studying case studies. Robert Tamsin Wilson, famous psychedelic wizard. There seem to be lots of different realities going around these days. It's what you get when you read the literature. Truths, he reminds us, case studies are always incomplete. Interpretations will differ over ambiguities. So, let's move on to reincarnation. The most interesting reincarnation cases, or apparent reincarnation cases anyway, are the memories from young children, typically between the ages of 2 to 9, who spontaneously volunteers memories of an apparent past life. And as many of you will no doubt be aware, the research was pioneered by Ian Stevenson at the University of Virginia, and current research is by the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University. Jim Tucker is the current chief research, but there are others. And at the moment they have about 2,500 cases. So, fairly typical cases. A lot of the cases that Stevenson studied were from countries that where belief in reincarnation was strong. So countries like from the Druzes in the Lebanon, from India, and from the Far East. And when I emailed Jim Tucker, actually, and he suggested the case of James Leininger would be a significant one. Born to American Christian family. He was born on April 10th, 1998. And according to his parent, this is from Jim Tucker's report, the first notable incident occurred in February 2000 when he was 22 months old. His father took him to the Canaveral Flight Museum outside of Dallas, and James was fascinated by the planes and in particular the World War II exhibit. They got a video of planes and James started watching him, although Tucker is quick to say that the information that the child later volunteered doesn't seem to be from that source. They made a second trip to the museum on a Memorial Day weekend. And then within 2 months of the first trip, James developed a habit of saying airplane crash on fire and slamming his toy planes nose first into the family's coffee table. He repeated this behaviour over and over, producing dozens of scratches and dents on the table. James's father travelled a lot, and when James's mother would see him off at the airport, James would often say, "Daddy, airplane crash on fire." This happened repeatedly, and then he begins having very bad nightmares. And according to his parents, these nightmares weren't just one or two. They were very persistent over a period of weeks and months. His behaviour during them seems to involve only screams at first, but included words as well. Airplane crash on fire. And then when he was 28 months old, he starts volunteering more information, claiming that he'd had a life where he'd flown off his plane off in a boat. And when his parents asked him the name of the boat, he said Natoma. After the conversation, his father searched online and found a description of the USS Natoma Bay, an escort carrier stationed in the Pacific, according to World War II. And basically, his father carried on doing research. He was, because of his religious background, his father was at first claims that he was reluctant to consider that this might be a past life. But to cut a long story short, more research was done, and the sister of the past life that was remembered was found. A number of... Here is a summary of some of the statements that were made by James Leininger, and eventually, basically, they found a life, a man called James Hudson, who died in the Battle of Iwo Jima in World War II. So there were claims like, died in the Battle of Iwo Jima, check, nightmares of plane crashing on fire and sinking and being able to get out, flew a Corsair, they were able to find the report. Aircraft action report says no wreckage of the plane was left alone. Pictures of Huston with Corsairs. And there was some slight confusion over the plane, I think. But plane flew off a boat. This plane was shot down on a Japanese. Corsairs got flat tires when they landed. Air Force historian interviewed in the segment, state of Corsairs bounced. This was in an ABC News interview I think there was an unbroadcasted documentary on this case as well. So I think I'm sort of skimming details a little bit, but basically this is the broad sort of picture you get. And Stevenson distinguishes between solved and unsolved cases. Solved cases are where the past life has been able to track down, ideally by the researcher, although a lot of the time the family does that first, but not always. and unsolved ones where they haven't been able to find the past life. So I'm going to swiftly move on. Got about 15 minutes, haven't we? So another dimension of these reincarnation or alleged or cases suggestive of reincarnation is birthmarks and birth defects, where basically a certain percentage of the cases include sort of basically moles or hyperpigmented macule. That's basically sort of a mole or a skin mark that seems to correspond to, say, a wound that a previous life experienced. So this is a hyperpigmented macule, basically a birthmark, or a, it's probably technically not that, but that's close enough, the person of the discussion. On the chest of a youth who recalled the life of Mir Ram, and here's a drawing of the shotgun wounds on Ram's chest. So that's an interesting feature of the cases, actually. About 70% of them, the previous life has died violently, or there's been some dramatic incident. So typically, there are a number of ways that this can present. There's sort of birth defects like this one, basically the foreshortened fingers. Or the boy in India have memories of a previous life who put his hand in a fodder chopping machine. Yeah, very nasty. Let's just have a quick look at that one. Yeah, here we go. Shows the fingers perhaps I should do a trigger warning on this, actually. In a child of India, who said he remembered the life of another child who put his right hand into the blades of a fodder chopping machine and lost his finger. Most cases of brachydactyly involved only a shortening of the middle flanges. In the present case, they're just stubs. So this is quite rare, or Stevenson is claiming that it's quite rare. But again, a curious coincidence, if nothing else. And it's noticed one interesting feature, and this comes out in a more recent paper by Tucker and Kyle from 2013 from Thailand, is that an alternate possibility is that basically, rather than being corresponding to a wound or a wound from a previous life, there is a tradition amongst some cultures who accept reincarnation that if you mark someone, say with soot, that at the point of death, that mark will reappear in the next life. And what's so interesting about the case studies that Tucker and Kyle discovered in Thailand is that I said before that most of these cases are associated with violent death, and the mark seems to correspond to that. Whereas here, this was from one of his daughters. This is a maternal grandfather. He died in his home village, a neighbouring village to AW's home when he was 59. So that's the previous life. One of his daughters decided to mark his body. She knew about the practice but did not follow the specific tradition. She said she wanted to know whether rebirth would happen, made a mental wish and marked it on the foot. And then basically, with the next birth, it was a close relative, this mark appeared that seemed to correspond to the mark that had been made with a previous life. And similar thing to here, the face of the person whose death's door was smeared with soot, marked with soot on the cheek by grandfather. So let's move swiftly on to the critics. I have to say that I don't think the criticisms are quite as thorough at this point. It's partly perhaps because Stevenson's work is so voluminous, and actually Angel complains about how voluminous it is, although frankly you know, it's actually quite slight compared with, say, the vast outpourings of neuroscience or whatever. Anyway, there are people who've always questioned Stevenson's methods. The Ransom Report was written by a former research assistant of Stevenson, who made some critics that have been critiques that have been relied upon ever since. So he highlights Stevenson's need for interpreters, suggests that perhaps these cases were distorted over time, and notes that only brief periods were spent with at least some of the witnesses, and he sort of noticed what he thought were problems in the reportage. And he also noticed the quite low ratio, only 11 of the over 1,000 cases Ransom looked at, there had been no contact between the families of the deceased and the child before the interview. So the problem there is, of course, the potential for conventional leakage of knowledge is significant. So, and then he claims 7 of the 11 cases were seriously flawed. Shermer has claimed that a lot of the correspondences are much less remarkable than they seem, and it's based on the human tendency to find meaningful patterns in, I think that means it should be meaningless and random noise. And Angel has made more extensive critiques that the correspondences could be chance, and he wants a controlled experimental test to rule this out. Although I'd suggest that's, without going into details, that's probably harder than he thinks it's going to be. Although, in fairness, if you read the reports, Stevenson goes over each of these, and actually Tucker does as well, the possibilities at length. But I think, actually, and I'm going to read this full, I think the metaphysical objections, again, really leap out when you're reading the critiques. This is from Edwards, who wrote quite a philosopher. He wrote a number of critiques of this material. It's summarised in a book called Reincarnation, which you can get in the SPL library, like a lot of the others. If Stevenson's reports are evidence for reincarnation, they must also be evidence for many collateral assumptions. He means astral bodies, you know, the assumption that spirits have a waiting zone, that they can see which body they're going into. And he claims these assumptions are fantastic, if not indeed pure nonsense, and even the absence of a demonstration of specific flaws, the rational person will either conclude that Stevenson's reports are defective or that his alleged facts can be explained without bringing in reincarnation. So what he's essentially saying is that the assumptions, if reincarnation true, were so absurd that the reports have to be flawed in some way, and that what seems paranormal is actually very normal. And what that says to me, again, is we come back to this point of worldview being crucial to judging the plausibility of evidence. We're running a little low on time, so I'd like to skip ahead to the conclusion, really, but I think we've got most of it. Like I said, Stevenson actually is quite thorough in documenting the weaknesses as well as the strengths of the cases. Cases have been investigated by indigenous researchers. Satwan Parish is a nice example, and which have generally confirmed the pattern Stevenson's found. And I leave it open as to how plausible people find Angel's objections. And I think we're going to have to skip transplant cases, interesting though they are. One thing I would say is that this is a body of recent cases. It's basically where people who've had a transplant seem to get the personality characteristics of. We can discuss that a bit more at the end if you like. Nice quote from Alan Gould. Alan, touchstone of very careful thinking in this field, and also a survivor committee member. Most of the protagonists will continue to reject the opposite camp data without any adequate scrutiny, purely on faith. Faith that because their own findings and interpretations are unshakable, the other fellows' findings and interpretations cannot merit serious study. I do not like this rejection of data on faith. It is as best a not very honest way of protecting oneself from the labour of having to adjust one's opinions. In other words, we shouldn't cherry pick. We should try and have a broad view of what the evidence is and try and be inclusive. I believe very strongly, and I hope it's come across in this lecture, of putting all of the cards on the table
I believe it's intellectually honest to do that. And one, if I had one critique of the literature, I would say that people are very good at cherry picking. You know, from either, whichever camp you're talking about. You know, and so, I think we have quite a strong argument to say, to follow Haskell Taliaferro, who wrote the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy's entry on the afterlife. With regard to this entire body of evidence, both in parapsychology and NDDs, we may be close to an impasse. In other words, it's actually quite tricky because of the massive impact that worldview, experience, etc. has. And the evidence is of such a nature. I think that's the concession that we need to make to Irwin when he suggested it's not strictly empirically testable for a couple of reasons, which I think I'll think about in a minute. However, I would say from looking at this, and obviously I haven't had a chance to look at everything, arguments against paranormal interpretations of near-death experiences seem to me, and again we can argue about this, seem stronger than for reincarnation. In other words, I think when I was reading through the paper, you know, like I said, I was trying to be honest and as thorough as I could. I thought basically Augustine's stuff on that made me doubt more than some of the critics' work that I've read. You know, you find your opinion changes when you, depending on who you read a lot of the time. Or maybe I'm just shallow, I don't know. And then in some ways there's simply a lot of ambiguities in the cases. We're looking at cases, they're incomplete. So a lot of it does come down to a balance of probabilities, how we reconstruct what happened, how it fits into our broader world picture, what our emotional experiences have had. So we've had people with very strong experience, personal experiences that are suggestive of survival to them. And then we've had, say, Daniel Ball's experience, where he's had a very personal experience with his father having that terrible stroke, which has suggested the opposite. And the people that I speak to informally that only confirms that issue. Anyone know what movie that's from? No? Yes! Well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man. So I sort of end by saying, confirming the survival experience is a significant phenomenological reality. Near deaths, okay, I've said perhaps things that are a bit, I don't know, critical of those, but on the transpersonal psychology side, they're extremely powerful experiences, they're life transforming, and they're realer than real to the people that experience them. And it's what William James said about mysticism, actually, in the varieties of religious experience, that for the person, they're utterly life transforming, and they transform the whole worldview. Strictly empirically, I'm putting aside sort of, you know, I have a lot of private, we all have private thoughts and wonders about this, but if I was to be strictly and someone was to put a gun to my head, I would say I don't know if any aspect of human consciousness, personality survives death. I'm intrigued by the possibility. I wonder a bit. The cases make me wonder a bit. And the critique's case isn't strong enough to make me want to reject everything. So we're back to a worldview versus evidence problem. And I wonder a bit whether this is a clash of mythologies between an older mythology of ghosts and spirits and a newer mythology. That's a novel I just read, but basically it has human uploading in it. So you've got to bear in mind the same guys who are pushing neurological mind readers are also expecting to upload their consciousness into computers. And to do that, physicalism needs to be true. And I wonder sometimes in a situation is what you expect, what you get. Speculations. It may be that the apparent contradiction that we've been worrying about for the course of the lecture is an illusion. Gould suggests an unknown intervening factor. There have been all sorts of speculations about a filter theory, that the brain filters information rather than generates it. I thought I'd deliberately soft-pedal that. But I wonder, this really is that basically, and Bernard can confirm or deny this, that in the 19th century there are some experiments seem to show that light was wave-like and some that seem to show it was particle-like. and that the discordant data was only resolved by a broader understanding. And maybe there are limitations to neuroscience, you know. And I'm just drawn to Tibetan Buddhism. I'm very interested. I go up to Sami Ling whenever I can. That's very nice, very tranquil place, unless you're in the kitchens. And of course, you've got alternate, non-Western points of view. So this was a suggestion he made at one of the Mind Life discussions with Western scientists. Gross levels of consciousness are contingent on the body. So the Dalai Lama wouldn't actually have a problem with a lot of the brain function thing. But in their system, there also exists subtle or very subtle or primordial mind, which would be invisible to brain scans. I'm going to skip the hints of process, just to ask this, really, that I think there are limits to our knowledge. None of this is to say that studying these issues isn't worthwhile, that studying these cases isn't worthwhile. But again, I think Bernard might confirm or deny this. I got this from Wikipedia. Cosmological horizon is a measure of distance from one which could possibly retrieve information. That's something in astronomy and cosmology, a nice pretty picture there. And in some ways, the boundaries of life represent a horizon. We're all bound by the limits of our living consciousness. And what's beyond that, you know, is you know, it's the undiscovered country, isn't it? To quote a Klingon. Primary boundary of the human world. And I think, if for nothing else, you know, I believe it's premature just to chuck these things out and not listen to people who've had extraordinary experiences. But at the same time, I think from our particular perspective, it's quite often difficult to decide exactly what those experiences mean and what they are. And that's about it, really. I think we're on time, aren't we?
Thank you very much, Matt. It's very wide-ranging and a nice spot of information there. Now, I'm sure that some of you may have some questions or comments. Bernard?
Thank you, Matt. Actually, when you say, is death a cosmological horizon, I think some people might argue that life is the cosmological horizon.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you're dead, you should see the
other horizon. Yes, I get what you're saying.
I just want, you mentioned briefly at the end, you know, you made this reference to the filter theory of consciousness.
Yeah.
And it sort of does seem to me that, in some sense, that's the fundamental issue, certainly from the point of view of psychical research, is consciousness generated by the brain or is consciousness filtered through the brain? And I must confess, I veer towards the second view, and it seems to me that the evidence of psychical research as a whole supports that. But I would like to ask you, as a philosopher, to what extent the view that consciousness is filtered through the brain has to imply survival. Because, you know, you might argue that when you die, your consciousness just gets absorbed into the great oceans with no individual survival. So I'm just interested, is there a halfway point? Because you started off showing all the belief systems of the various sorts of physicalists. Is there a sort of halfway point where you can believe that the brain is a filter of consciousness, but that you don't necessarily believe in survival?
Yes, I think there is. And I think that's demonstrated by people who research psychedelic drugs and things. There's theories like the thalamic gate theory, where essentially our perceptions are filtered, and psychedelic drugs, you know, it's the Aldous Huxley thing, they interfere with the filter. And I think, you know, if you're thinking about survival, I'll put it this way, I think if you're thinking about survival, something like the filter theory is probably necessary. But you're not necessarily going to, if you accept some form of filter theory, you're not necessarily going to accept survival as an addition. But it opens the door. I think this was the sense that I got reading in the anthology What Survives. Colin Wilson was talking about these experiences open to a wider reality. And I think that's why near deaths are so suggestive of survival for those who experience them. It's similar to mystical experiences that we can intellectually it's why I said strictly empirically, we can intellectually discuss this, but I think in practice we don't just bring to the table empirical, you know, none of us are strictly scientific all of the time, and our experiences and experiencing life-changing mystical experience in the context of an NDE or not is life-changing.
Yeah.
But it's not strictly rational, it's trans-rational, if you like.
But I mean, most concepts of personal survival somehow involve the concept of, like, the subtle body.
Yes.
And then that raises the question of, is the subtle body a filter too?
Yeah, well, I've wondered about that myself, and it's one reason why I self-peddled the filter theory idea, and there's an interesting discussion in that book, you know, where they discuss all of these issues with some very hard-nosed neuroscientists back in the 1990s, and I think what comes across is that, for me anyway, is that Tibetan monks seem more open-minded than the, you know, the scientists are very decided on what they know, but the Tibetans seem to be wanting to accommodate it within this broader picture. So I thought that was a slightly different frame from you know, Ed and et al's work.
Thanks for a very interesting talk, Matt, because I've read around the subject and I've hit a number of the roadblocks that you've hit.
Glad I'm not the only one.
I'm glad that you found the same sort of problems that I have. Last year at the SPR conference, we had a very interesting presentation from a medium who was studying mediumistic experiences through the use of EEGs. So the EEG power was right down, even below the level of meditation, when the mediums were actually connecting to something.
Right.
So this raises the issue that, exactly following on from what Bernard was saying, if the power in the brain goes down because of near-death experience, for example, brain's maybe starved of oxygen or whatever, then is the delocalization of consciousness, is that coming into play in order that something is there, something may be preserved, possibly, or that it's simply a question of kind of pushback, the group consciousness or whatever it is able to get more of an inroad into the mind because the brain isn't functioning at such a high level. So I wondered what your thoughts were about that.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'd be interested to see the reports on that, actually. But it reminds me a little bit again of the psilocybin studies that Carhart Harris did, where the more profound experiences seem to be correlated with a lower level of, it was particularly the default mode network, and there's this idea, of course, that corresponds very roughly to the ego, and that corresponds a lot to the mystical practice, meditative practice, which the idea is to quiet the noise. And actually, I would say that that's a point score in, on the side of the transpersonal, because, I think one of the things, it's in Browdy's book actually, that quite often we consider these things in isolation. But again, looking at it as a whole, it really feeds into your whole worldview again. It's whether you're basically willing to accept a certain interpretation, not just of near deaths, but of mystical experiences, of what consciousness is doing when the brain goes quiet. You know, it's that sort of gestalt. It's an overused word, but that's what a paradigm is. It's a gestalt of very different things. And I think this is, you do get people talking past one another, and a refusal to take each other's view seriously, which is a bit frustrating when reading through the literature. But yeah, I think that's an interesting study, by the sound of it.
Hello. Mine was more of a bit like a sociological question. And the motivation.
You mentioned
1,111 cases whereby 11 of them
had
contact
with
the family.
Yeah.
You mentioned that it was in countries that were Eastern, like India, Thailand.
Yes.
What bounds of probability do you give, or do you know about the motivation of the families to contact another family, whereby it might be a different social economic status?
Yes, I mean, first of all, there are quite a few cases where someone from a, you know, with the memories, someone from a higher caste, say, has been reincarnated in a, or allegedly, you know, reincarnated in a lower caste. But I think one of the criticisms Stephen Brownlee makes of Stevenson is, and other researchers, is that research into possible psychological motivations tends to be a bit shallow. You know, we tend to look at the cases in isolation for their, you know, for their anomalous content. And this is where the humanities side of things is really important. I don't know about you, but I find reading about that side of things at least is interesting because it really furnishes us with more details. And a lot of the time when I was, you know, watching Jeffrey Iverson's In Search of the Dead, partly to research, it's a documentary that was done about back in the 1990s, but it had a few of the reincarnation cases, and actually watching the people go through their everyday lives, it's like you do begin to think about that sort of question: what are the motivations here? You know, what's, you know, and obviously in some cases it's like there's a, I don't know whether it was the same chap who'd had the foreshortened hand, but there was obviously some psychological, you know, I could think of potential psychological motivations for wanting in the ring, you know, particularly the ones that we saw with the soot smear. That's a very strong, I'm not claiming that explains everything, but it's a very strong psychological motivation. Obviously, people were wanting to come, these people to come back, to welcome them back into the family. That's the problem with replacement reincarnations. It's where someone replaces someone that's, you know, you could think of a lot of very potent psychological explanations for that sort of situation. So I would say that if moving this research forward, sometimes it would be nice to have more of that sort of thinking in detail. And I don't know what the DOPS guys, I think they've been trying, they've been trying to sort of have a look at that a little bit more in recent years. But it, you know, I think that's probably very important.
I think poverty is a strong motivation.
I think, you know, certain families that live in poverty or have children live in poverty, it's a psychological drive to say, look, you know, there's a family over here that if we know information about them, we can then concoct a story to say this person might have been reincarnated into your family. So
yeah,
this is my cynical brain.
It's an obvious possibility, and I think, in fairness, Stevenson quite often goes through these. But, you know, going back to Marcello Truzzi's comments on the incompleteness of, we're studying case reports, and they're always going to be incomplete. There are always things you're not going to know unless you actually go back to the place and re-interview. Even then, you know, I mean, I think Edelman, I think, in the Journal of Consciousness Studies, they were proposing, oh, this is how to make it scientific. And he's sort of a neuroscientist of consciousness. And some of the propositions to make it really scientific, I thought these are very nice in theory, but, it's obvious that these guys don't have an idea how difficult it is to conduct fields. You know, I mean, the proposition was basically that for each reincarnated family, you get four independent teams of judges going in one at a time and independently judging it. I was thinking, great in theory, but I can't imagine a family putting up with that kind of, and that's the problem. We have limits with the evidence, limits with how complete reports are, and conflicting reconstructions. So again, it's down to a balance of probabilities and what each person thinks.
Thank you. Yeah, just coming back to the example we gave Pat Reynolds for the NDE.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there are a couple of very detailed accounts, one by Anita Morshani and Evan Alexander,
of a lot
of things that happened in their NDEs. Because it really comes down to what you regard as evidence that's found externally during some sort of period of time when a person came to be dead. But I don't know if you've read a book by Alan Hamilton called Scalp and Soul, who's a neuroscientist who actually has a very similar case to Pam Reynolds. Somebody was clinically dead during a surgery and is able to recount external influences. I mean, that's, I just wondered what your thoughts were about the Morshani and Evan Alexander accounts. And finally, very quick comment. When we talk about Bernard's point about survival, does it have to be a personal survival, or are we really meaning linked to some sort of higher forms of consciousness, which is otherwise external when physically present? I mean, that's, I don't know.
Well, just returning, I mean, the case I saw at, I think it was Beyond the Brain 2018, was it Evan Alexander came, and I actually saw him discuss his near-death experience, and I read his, I got his book at that, and again, you've got this controversy, haven't you? Because, I mean, he, some of his claims were questioned in various avenues. In the Esquire article, I think. And I think Bruce Grayson produced the medical an examination of the medical conditions around that near-death experience. Actually, the Dalai Lama, he we've got to examine this very carefully. I think it's very interesting listening to that discussion, but so, this is the problem. It's the problem that I've always had with this, with near deaths. It's that they're fascinating to read, very rich in text, and they're obviously transformative, but it's a bit like, you know, picking up jelly with a knife sometimes, actually pinning down. Perhaps this is sort of being exposed to the sort of the skeptical side of things, and I'm always thinking, what would an unsympathetic prosecutor? And you think about this with some of the reincarnation cases too, that you know, the unsympathetic, the case for the prosecution, there's that bit and that bit that could be questioned. And of course the thing is that I think it's possible on the other side of things to go too far with that and to have no certainty whatsoever, but what it does is, if you fully and frankly read the debates, it lowers the level of certainty. So we can, you know, thinking back to Trutz's sort of levels of confirmation, you know, I'd certainly say these cases are suggestive of something. And occasionally there are remarkable cases that seem, you know, conventional explanations seem to fall short. So we do have anomalies in this database. It's knowing what to make of them. And the second question about transpersonal. Yeah, well, that's another possibility, isn't it? I mean, I seem to remember Arthur Koestler. He believed in the transpersonal afterlife, or thought he did before. Anyway, so that's another possibility, isn't it? That we don't actually, that we go, and it's suggested in some ways by mystical experience where the self seems to dissolve and...
Yeah, it was just a quick question about the current state of neuroimaging kind of supporting physicalism.
Yes.
So you mentioned that you can control drones at the moment.
Yeah.
But there's quite a long, it's quite a big leap from there to actually be able to kind of mind read and upload consciousness and what have you.
Yeah.
How far can you get with that? Would we ever get to the point where you can support the idea that there is a true physicalism, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of researchers have seemed very confident. You know, there are discussions in the New Scientist, and they seem to think that eventually everything will be readable, absolutely everything. I think you've got to distinguish between hype and between what's actually been achieved so far, and I think there are two things. Firstly, what exactly does this say about the mind-body problem, which is consciousness? And I think I had discussions with this with Alan and a few other people on a while back, and less than you might think. I think the reason why I'm foregrounding it so much is firstly because you get people like Daniel Ball claiming that this is the proof positive. It's what, you know, settles all of the argument. You know, we don't need to worry about philosophy anymore. Now, I don't agree with that. I sort of deliberately didn't say that. I think that's problematic. And I think you know, I understand where he's coming from, I understand because of experience, etc. But, for example, Philip Goff has come out, you know, he's a philosopher, talking about panpsychism or neutral monism. There's actually, because those pesky philosophers, I think, have a point, you know, that, and I think that physicalists often miss the point. People aren't arguing that, I don't think anyone in this field is arguing that, you know, for a simple form of, like, say, Cartesian dualism, where there's a self hovering above your body and it sort of vaguely interacts with the brain somehow. I think the argument has definitely moved on. And sometimes, from the hardline physicalist side of things, they write as if people think that. And I don't think anyone, you know, talk to, you know, Ed Kelly or Alan, or I don't think anyone thinks that's it, or you know, Hasker, who wrote the Stanford entry, you know. So I think I've lost track of what we're talking about. But I think it means less than is claimed. But I think my point is that in the years to come, as this technology becomes more prominent, it's going to be an obvious question that we're going to get asked. And that intellectual honesty requires that we tackle and engage with the hardest. You know, you don't go for the weakest arguments, you go for the strongest arguments to see what you can resolve. And that's important. I think Karl Popper said that.
Is anyone else? Thank you for a very interesting and balanced talk. On one, looking at it one way, it's very balanced. Looking at it another way, it's extremely unbalanced. Now, the unbalanced side is what nobody ever talks about when discussing these, you know, the case for or against survival. And that is, we want to look at and analyse the point of view and the way of thinking of the sceptics and the non-sceptics. This is an area which has not, so far as I know, been analysed at all. And it seems to me vital. We're not going to arrive at any sort of conclusion until we look at the people who are judging. So that's my feeling about it. There's a whole area which is quite unexamined, and it's very important.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue with that. And in fact, I think people at the University of Northampton and elsewhere have started, and actually Chris French, who's a sceptic, there have been more efforts in recent years to look at the psychology of the sceptic as well as, I think, this is another area where it's very easy to be dishonest. The reason is that it's very easy to point at other people and say those people have, you know, dreadful motivations for what they... I think, you know, to have an in-depth understanding of where people are coming from, you know, a lot of it involves being less, you know, being, you know, willing to listen to their point of view, even if you don't agree with it. But I think what you said actually backs up kind of what I'm saying, which is that, again, it comes as a whole package, how individual and groups see the world. So how you think about one thing is going to affect how you see the other, and understanding the emotional, in science actually, and again, Trinity commented on this, the emotional content. So one of the most notable thing about a lot of the more hardline skeptical side of thing is how angry they get. I mean, but then I've seen a lot of emotionality as well. You know, I think we're all capable of that, but it's... I think, yes, absolutely, people have different points of view. And I think that, we need to know more about that and the dynamics of that and how that plays out in scientific debates. Because there are debates on a lot of things, aren't there? I mean, just on nutrition is another one that I happen to have had quite a lot of research on there. And if you think the debate over parapsychology is acrimonious, debates in nutrition leave, you know, I mean, on it, and that's quite interesting, isn't it? So that something so simple should remain so controversial. But yes, there's very definitely a lot of heavy emotional content in these debates, and I think online has made things a lot worse. You know, because this is the rabbit hole. You know, that it's very tempting to remain within one's bubble.
Just in front, please.
Hello again. Yeah, I'm biased because I've done mediumistic over the years, and I'm aware of the survival of the personality. And I spoke to Bernard about this, about information. It's all out there. But what I'm hearing about the modern science, neuroscience, and AI, I'm a bit, it's because we're living in a secular age, we're forgetting what we're really about. And I'm really pleased that you're trying to enhance, because it's not just a worthy thing, it's paramount, you know, but I am biased, because my experiences, I'm not deluding myself, but at the same time, you know, it's there, it's not there. Always like to say, the prison, you can't, the subtle is in the mind, but it's not in the physical. You know, you experience clairvoyance, you get information, but then what can you do with it? You just sit there and you go back to your little spiritist church and just go around and around in circles, and it's a movement, it's not progressing.
Thank you. I think that's a really good point about forgetting, and I think one of the reasons why, you know, that's one of the things that's made me more sympathetic to a lot of. You got to bear in mind where I came from, that you know, I'd still have a lot of sympathies for sort of liberal physicalism, really, but an engagement with a sort of another culture, you know, made me wonder about a lot of these things a lot more and think a lot harder about how, you know, sort of, it's that Alan Gould quote, isn't it, you know, the labour of adjusting one's opinions, that when you're faced with a culture that accepts that some children are going to be reborn, and you know, reading the Dalai Lama's biography when he came over from the West, he said one of the reasons why he got together with the scientists was he wanted to understand about the fortune telling in Tibet, and the cases of reincarnation, you know, what substance was that, and you know, and there are other cultures as well, you know, another one that I've been reading about is the Amazonian cultures, you know, this sort of ayahuasca experience, and Jeremy Narbis, where, you know, he said, how have you got all this botanical knowledge, and they went, well, you know, we took ayahuasca and the plants told us. You know, and I think this is something to bear in mind, that it's very easy to get into that very Western tunnel that we go to science for everything, or our kind of science, but there are indigenous cultures, and in a way, I suppose you could see, you know, the sort of mediumistic churches as a kind of indigenous culture of here. You know, so... you know, I think whatever I think, I would never necessarily, you know, I always think there's something to learn from another perspective, and that's what, in another context, I think the biggest issue that I have with sort of the more hardline guys like Dawkins is this seeking to close down. You know, that I think. That closing down, saying, no, we've got all the answers, we know basically what the universe is like. I think that's woefully premature, whatever you think about any of this stuff. And that you can always learn something from another angle, you know?
I think on that point, we will close the discussion. I'd like to thank Matt very much for a very wide-ranging and excellent talk. I'm sure we've all learned quite a lot this evening. Thank you.